last time at the end of class, we came to the realization that the membrane is really a structure best described as a fluid mosaic. The membrane is not a simple sandwich with lipid in the middle. It's more like a layer of lipid with various kinds of crackers on both sides and pickles and stuff in the middle. So today I want to start by talking a little bit more about what we mean by the fluid part of the model and the mosaic part of the model. So if we draw a standard membrane, we know that it contains a bilayer of lipid. This is a single membrane, a bilayer with its associated proteins. The fluid part refers largely, if not entirely, to the lipid, because the lipid can float in the plane of the membrane. So the lipid can diffuse around the surface of the cell. Now, this is a cross-section of a cell, so the membrane extends out. And these lipids can diffuse over the entire surface of the membrane. And this is called lateral diffusion or lateral movement, and this is very fast. However, if you consider a single molecule of lipid, there's another kind of movement that's possible. And that's going from one side of the bilayer to the other side of the bilayer, either from the in to the out or the out to the in. Now, this is usually simply called a flip-flop because you have to turn the lipid over. You have to flip it over so the head now faces the other way. Now, this, it turns out, is slow. And the reason is that there's a high energy barrier to doing this, because in order to flip the lipid over, you have to move the hydrophilic head through the hydrophilic phobic tail region. So that is not energetically favorable. Therefore, flip-flop is very slow. In the absence of enzymes, it takes hours. Therefore, you can have different lipids on the two sides of the membrane, or different proportions of lipid on the two sides, because the two sides don't get scrambled in the absence of enzymes. But there are enzymes that catalyze the movement of lipid from one side to the other. And since they catalyze flip-flop, they're usually called flipases. And in the presence of the appropriate enzyme, a lipid can move across the membrane to the other side. And therefore, depending on which enzymes are present, a particular type of lipid can be just on one side, just on the other half, or distributed on both. Now, the lipid is free to move laterally. Some proteins are. Many proteins are not, because they're anchored to the cytoskeleton, as we'll explain. Now, I don't want to say much more about the lipid, but I want to now look at the protein, which is largely what is meant by the mosaic part, mosaic as in tiles, not in Ten Commandments. We explained last time that the protein can be distributed in many different places in this membrane. And what I want to talk about is the various types of proteins you would find in a membrane. These are classified experimentally by how easy it is to get them off the membrane. And the characterization of membrane proteins is now on the top of 3B. Now, here is a section of the membrane again with the bilayer. And there can be proteins on either side, and there can be proteins that go all the way through. And there are other kinds of proteins as well, as we'll explain in a minute. Now, how would you characterize these various proteins? It says at the handout, at the top, that you have a membrane. Now, of course, the membrane comes from a cell. What you do is you crack the cell open and you wash out everything soluble, all the other organelles and soluble materials, and you're left with the membrane. Now, if you take this membrane, lipid and protein, and dissolve it in detergent, you can separate the various proteins by gels, SCS gels, etc. But that gives you all the proteins, all of these. On the other hand, instead of dissolving the lipid, what you can do is change the salt or the pH conditions so as to break weak bonds but not covalent bonds. And in that case, the proteins attached to the membrane by weak bonds fall off, and the membrane, the proteins that are strongly attached stay on. So you get two classes of proteins, as it says on your handout. You get intrinsic, also called integral proteins, and you get extrinsic, also called peripheral proteins. Now, how does that... So this is what comes off, and this is what stays. Now, how does that compare in terms of our picture? The two proteins here are peripheral or extrinsic proteins. These are attached by weak bonds, and manipulating the salt or the pH will knock them off. And you notice there are two kinds. There are those that are on the outside, and those that outside, and those that are on the inside. Now, what about the intrinsic or integral proteins that remain associated with the membrane? One way of getting them off is simply to dissolve or disrupt the membrane. So if you dissolve the membrane, you dissolve the bilayer by adding detergent, etc., you can see that if you dissolve, what's going to be left? If you dissolve the bilayer, you're going to release your transmembrane proteins. And these are the classic form of integral or intrinsic proteins. But there's another kind of protein that's hard to get off. And that's the remaining part of your picture over here. Some proteins are attached covalently to lipid. And they can be on the outside or they can be on the inside. The lipid is inserted into the membrane and holds the protein in position. Now, how can you get these proteins off? If you dissolve the bilayer, clearly you release the protein, although it's still connected to its tail. But another way to get these proteins off is to break the covalent bond between the lipid and the protein. So if you do that, you don't break all covalent bonds, but just the one between lipid and protein, then you release these so-called lipid-anchored proteins. And you notice there are two kinds. Some of them are inside, and some of them are out. Some people consider lipid-anchored proteins and transmembrane proteins all to be integral proteins or intrinsic proteins because they're hard to get off. But you probably know that when it comes to classification, there are lumpers and splitters. There are people who like more classifications and less. And some people see three classes of proteins here: the extrinsic proteins, the intrinsic proteins, and the lipid-anchored proteins as a separate category. We're not going to talk much at all about lipid-anchored proteins. I just want you to be aware that they exist because they're an interesting bunch of proteins. We're going to stick mostly to transmembrane proteins and the extrinsic ones. Now, what about transmembrane proteins? They, too, come in two kinds, which are referred to as single-pass and multi-pass. Now, what do we mean by that? If you go back to, say, a lipid here, a single pass protein is one that only transverses the membrane once. So the carboxyl end is on one side and the amino end is on the other. It can be either way. And a protein like this is said to have three domains. You can see it in this picture. You can see it in this picture. There's the middle domain that goes through the membrane, the part that's outside and the part that's inside the cell. So this is called the extracellular domain. The part inside is the intracellular domain. And then the part in the middle that goes through the membrane, that's called the transmembrane domain. Now, I have a model of this sort of protein. It looks sort of like, in this picture, this. Let's say the cell's down here, the cytoplasm's down here. So this would be the intracellular domain, the transmembrane domain, and the extracellular domain. Now, from this picture or model, it looks like the part that goes across the membrane is just a straight line. But in fact, this part of the protein is almost always an alpha helix. So the transmembrane domain is helical. So this would be a better model, something like this. This would be the intracellular domain, the transmembrane domain, and the extracellular domain. Now, the advantage of this setup now is this is going through lipid after all. This is where the bilayer is. So these amino acids that stick out here, the side chains would all be hydrophobic, thereby anchoring this in the membrane. Now there's another feature of these proteins. Transmembrane proteins in general tend to have carbohydrate chains, short branched sugar chains, on the extracellular domain. So they're up here. They're not found on the intracellular domain, and the reason for that is the way they're made. And we won't get back to that for a little while, but to make this a little clearer, if I can find my right piece, here they are. Didn't have any sugar cubes, but I had some sugar packets. So the sugars are attached. That sugar lost its stickum, but. So the short sugar chains are attached to the extracellular domain, and therefore the protein is said to be glycosylated. Now, this is a typical single pass protein, and here I see what happened to my sugar sticky. Got stuck on there. This is a typical single-pass protein, but we also have multi-pass proteins. What do they look like? So this would be a multi-pass protein. Again, we have the peptide chain. And the idea here is that the chain goes across the membrane more than once. So it goes transmembrane domain, extracellular, transmembrane domain, intracellular, transmembrane domain, extracellular, etc. Now, let's see, in this model, one end is in the cytoplasm and one end is extracellular. You can have both ends in the cytoplasm, both ends extracellular, or either way, one of each. Now, what about these transmembrane domains? They can be alpha helices, just like for a single pass protein. So there can be multiple alpha helices here. But alternatively, these sections actually can be extended in the so-called beta conformation so that this forms a beta sheet. But whether this is a collection of alpha helices or a beta sheet, often this is folded in three dimensions to form a pore or hole in the membrane. And this is arranged so that the hydrophobic side chains stick out this way into the lipid, locking the protein in. And the hydrophilic side chains go into the middle. So this is a water-filled pore. And this allows things to move in and out of the cell across the membrane bilayer. Now, if this were a typical multipass protein, if, say, this is the way it is in the bilayer, cytoplasm down, extracellular, where would the sugar be? If it's glycosylated, where will the chains be? They'll be here on the extracellular parts, here or here or here. Now, some of these proteins essentially float in the membrane, and some of them are anchored to the cytoskeleton. And both kinds, either kind, can be anchored or float. Now, what do these proteins do, these transmembrane proteins, single multipass? There are actually three kinds of basic functions they serve, and one of them we've just explained. That many of these proteins make up some kind of transport mechanism. They are, in essence, a door. So function one is for transport. The protein acts as a door. Now, it could be thought of as a swinging door or a revolving door, not necessarily just a hole. There are many variations, and we'll talk about them starting next time. But it allows passage of small molecules that can't get across lipid. It allows them to get across the membrane. Now, so this is a transport function. Many other of these transmembrane proteins act as receptors. And you can think of a receptor as being a trap. If you have a cell with a receptor, the receptor has a domain that's extracellular that stricts out. And if the appropriate matching molecule comes along, then it will attach to the receptor. The two will bind if they match up. Now, in other words, the receptor traps its partner. Now, what are the consequences of this? There are at least two possible ones. Sometimes the trapping of the molecule sends a signal to the inside of the cell that something has happened. So sometimes this is used in signaling that the molecule is on the outside, the cell should do something. Alternatively, sometimes the combination of the two triggers the internalization of the external molecule. Remember endocytosis from last time. Membranes can bulge in and form a vesicle. So sometimes the binding of a substance to its receptor triggers endocytosis. And you end up with the stuff from the outside in a vesicle inside. And this is called receptor mediated endocytosis, or RME. And we will talk later, just as we'll talk about how small molecules get across, we'll talk about how big molecules get internalized by RME. Now, the third function that these proteins serve is as links. You can have a protein that is transmembrane, and it is connected to the cytoskeleton on the inside of the cell and is connected to material on the outside of the cell. Either material between cells, which is called the extracellular matrix, or the ECM. So it can be connected to the extracellular matrix, or it can be connected to a protein from another cell. We tend to concentrate on cells and what's inside them, but cells make a very large number of proteins that are then secreted and fill the spaces between cells. And that's what the extracellular matrix is. The most common protein in your body is actually extracellular, not inside. So they link the cytoskeleton to either the extracellular matrix or another cell. Now, we've been talking here sort of in generalities, and I want to talk about a specific membrane and its specific proteins. Each membrane of an organelle or of the plasma membrane has a different collection of these proteins because it carries out a different function. The best known membrane in the world is the membrane of the red blood cell, or the erythrocyte. Now, the red blood cell is a very unusual cell. If we do a cross-section, it's shaped sort of like that, coming out here. It looks sort of like a Reed's butterscotch or a lifesaver without a hole. And this cell, unlike almost all the other eukaryotic cells, has no organelles, no nuclei, no formal cytoskeleton, or internal membranes. The precursor of this cell had all of those things. But after hemoglobin was made and packed in here, plus some other proteins, all the extra stuff was jettisoned. So the rest of the cell parts have been destroyed and lost. And this is basically a package of hemoglobin. And this cell cannot replace itself. It has no DNA, RNA, can't make new protein. These cells travel through the circulation and are then destroyed. And they have a relatively short half-life of 120 days. They are gradually used up, broken down, and replaced. Now, people have studied the plasma membrane extensively of the red blood cell. And one of the reasons for that is if you break this cell open and get a membrane, there's only one. So anything associated with a membrane here came from the plasma membrane. There are no complications due to internal membranes. So this is a good source of purified plasma membrane. Second of all, red blood cells are an almost inexhaustible supply. They're cheap and easy to get because you can get expired blood from a blood bank. And that's no good anymore for biological or health purposes, but it can be used for research. So the supply of red blood cells is practically inexhaustible. So what people do is to lyse or break open the cells. And when that happens, all of the soluble material inside the cell can be washed away. All the hemoglobin and any other stuff. And all that's left is the membrane and whatever is attached to it. And if you want to, you can reseal these. And if you reseal these, this membrane is no longer enclosing hemoglobin. So this is not red anymore, like a red blood cell. This is just a plain old package of membrane with, depending on what you put inside, usually just clear solution. So this looks white. And that's why these are called ghosts. And we'll explain next time how you use ghosts to study transport across membranes. But what we're interested in them for now is that this is essentially a purified preparation of plasma membrane. So you can take this membrane and dissolve it with detergents and isolate the proteins and get all the proteins of the plasma membrane. But you may remember from what we just said that there are two big classes of proteins in a membrane. There are the intrinsic proteins and the peripheral ones. So what people have done is to treat these to separate the peripheral and the integral, or intrinsic, to separate the two classes of proteins. They basically washed off what you can wash off, left what stays, except this would be what stays, This is what comes off. And then they have identified these proteins by running them on gels, largely by looking at them on SDS gels. Now, if you do that, what proteins do you get? You get a very famous class of proteins, and although they come from red blood cells, we think that virtually all eukaryotic cells have a very similar set of proteins doing the same function. And if you look at 3A now on the bottom, we have here a crude diagram of what a red blood cell membrane looks like. So if this is the bilayer, I actually want to talk first about some of the peripheral proteins, not about the integral ones first. You notice that there's a web here, really, of proteins. This protein is called spectrin. And spectrin forms a kind of web underneath the lipid bilayer. And remember, this is a cross-section, so this would be a whole round cell, and that means there's a web of spectrin all the way around. This is the closest thing the cell has to a cytoskeleton, and it has, connecting the spectrin, short lengths of microfilament, or actin. So this is actin. You remember that when actin polymerizes, it forms two chains that twist around each other. So this is a very short microfilament, or F-actin. And there is one other protein involved in holding this together. And this protein has the name of 4-1. Now, the reason for this is when they first isolated proteins from ghosts, and they ran them on SDS gels, they numbered the proteins 1, band 1, 2, 3, 4. Then they discovered that band 4 really had several proteins in it, so they called them 4-1, 4-2, etc. And because this is a structural protein, it doesn't have an enzymatic activity, its name is still 4-1. It has no other name. Another very famous protein they got is called band 3 protein. But since it has an activity, we usually call it by its other name. Now, this is a cross-section of the web. If you were to look instead this way, so here's your cell like an orange, and you look on top. If you peeled off the bilayer and you looked at the spectrin web, it looks quite different. It looks more like this. It forms an entire web where the connections are actin and 4-1, and the spokes are spectrin. If you take a look at the animated cell video, there's a very nice picture of this. And there are many pictures in your books and on the web. Now, every cell, eukaryotic cell, is thought to have something like this. There's probably something like this under virtually every membrane, holding it up and holding it in position. Now, the other integral protein, peripheral protein that's found here is called ankyrin. And it is actually a protein that anchors one of the integral proteins to the cytoskeleton. If you look at your membrane, you see there's one protein that's drawn like this. This is one of those multipass proteins that forms a channel or pore in the membrane. And this is the band 3 protein, also called the anion exchanger. And this is anchored to the cytoskeleton by a connecting protein, and that is ankyrin. So the anion exchanger band 3 protein is connected to ankyrin, and ankyrin is connected to the spectrin actin web. Now, on your picture, there are two proteins drawn, one multipass and one single pass. These are the two major proteins of the red blood cell membrane. The other one is drawn over here, something like this. This is a single-pass protein, which, as we said before, has an intracellular domain, a transmembrane domain, and an extracellular domain. Both of these proteins have short sugar chains. They are glycosylated on their extracellular domains. That's why the antlers. Now, as we explained before, this part, the transmembrane domain, is really an alpha helix, and we've just drawn it straight to keep the picture simple. And just to make it complete, this protein is called glycophorin. Now, what are the functions of these two proteins? These are the major red blood cell proteins, transmembrane. What is their function? We know the function of the anion exchanger. It turns out to be absolutely critical to the functioning of the red blood cell. In the early literature, it's sometimes called a channel, but we'll learn later, channels have somewhat different properties than it does. It's not just an open tube, but it's a transport mechanism that exchanges two anions. It exchanges bicarb and chloride. So either bicarb comes in and chloride goes out, or vice versa. The two always go in opposite directions, one for one. Now, why is this protein critical to the function of a red blood cell? Let's go back and look again at our red blood cell. I'm going to take out the hemoglobin for now, because in this context, that's not the critical thing. The cell has the exchanger that we've just discussed, which will allow bicarb to leave the cell and chloride to enter. Now, it can also be used in the opposite direction, chloride out, bicarb in. But we want to discuss this direction first. In the tissues, CO2 is generated by metabolism. We not only have to use red blood cells, it turns out, to get the oxygen from the lungs to the tissues, but we also use them in part to get the CO2 from the tissues up to the lungs, so we can exhale it. When CO2 is released in the tissues, it goes into the blood, but it's not very soluble in the blood. However, bicarb is very soluble. So if you can convert the CO2 to bicarb, you can load the blood up with CO2, essentially, carry it to the lungs, and expel it. And the way that's done is using in two steps. CO2 is a gas, so it can diffuse into red blood cells. And I realize this picture is on 3B on the bottom right. That inside red blood cells, you have an enzyme that catalyzes the reaction shown. CO2 plus water goes to bicarb plus a proton. And I'm going to just make my red blood cell bigger to fit it all in. And this is catalyzed by the enzyme carbonic anhydrase. This is a fairly famous enzyme because it has one of the highest turnover numbers known. It's a champion enzyme. So in the tissues, CO2 diffuses into the cells, and then with the enzyme carbonic anhydrase, it's converted to bicarb and protons. Now, you can't do the conversion outside because there's no enzyme. All the enzyme is inside the red blood cell. But now all this bicarb, courtesy of the exchanger, can be dumped in back into the blood in exchange for chloride. So the net effect is that the CO2 goes in, converted to bicarb, and goes back out into the blood. The net effect is the CO2 is converted to bicarb and floats in the blood. Now, this is all well and good, but what happens when the red blood cell gets to the lungs? Then you just reverse the entire process. We can start from this end. When you get to the lungs, CO2 is exhaled. So that means that the CO2 level is low, and whatever CO2 is in the red blood cell will diffuse out. That pulls the equilibrium of the reaction to the left. Any bicarb that's in the cell is converted to CO2 and is lost. But now if the bicarb inside the cell is low, then this exchanger works in the other direction. More bicarb is pulled into the cell, and the chloride is left. So bicarb goes into the cell, made back into CO2, leaves the red blood cell, and is exhaled. So to summarize it, it goes this way in the tissues, and it goes this way in the lungs. Basically, to the right in the tissues and the left in the lungs. So this protein is essential to the functioning of the cell in which it's found. Now, other cells have different transport proteins in their membranes because they serve different functions and carry out different things. This, in fact, has additional transport proteins. This is just the major one. So this is the function of the anion exchanger, or BAN3 protein. But what is the function of glycophorin? The amazing thing is that nobody knows. Glycophorin is a major important protein, but what it does is not clear. One theory is these sugars are negatively charged because they are modified. And one possibility is that what glycophorin does is to add a negative charge to the surface of the red blood cell. And this prevents one red blood cell from sticking to another and clumping. So that's one possibility. Another one is that the sugars on the red blood cell are gradually worn away with time as the red blood cell gets older, and therefore this serves as an indicator, the sugar on the glycophorin acts as an indicator of how old the red blood cell is. The more sugar, the younger it is. And when enough sugar has worn off, that is the signal to destroy the red blood cell and replace it. Now, whatever the natural function of glycophorin, we do know something about some aspects of this protein. This is not really a single protein, but a family of proteins that are similar, that are called glycophorin A, B, C, etc. It turns out that variations in one of the glycophorins are responsible for the MN blood group. And that's actually glycophorin A. There are two alleles of this gene, and therefore two forms of the protein that differ only in a few amino acids. And one form of the protein is the M, what we've called M, and one is N. So if you have only the alleles for M, you have only the M form of the protein and your blood type M. If you're homozygous for the other allele, you make only the N type protein and are homozygous N. And if you're heterozygote, you make both forms of the protein and therefore your MN blood group. So the MN blood group difference is due to amino acid changes in the protein, which is different from the ABO blood group, which is due to different sugars present on the surface. Now, the other interesting thing is something we know about glycophorin C. And that is that glycophorin C is the malaria receptor. That means that if this is what glycophorin C looks like, the malaria parasite sticks to this receptor. And that helps the parasite get into the cell, probably by receptor-mediated endocytosis. Now, this protein is called the malaria receptor. There are other proteins known as the HIV receptor. HIV and malaria are two different microorganisms. One is a virus, one is a protozoan. And these have different shapes, and so they stick to different surface proteins. Now, here I am talking about the HIV receptor and the malaria receptor. Why would you have a malaria receptor? Do you think you have a protein whose job it is to bind malaria, the malaria parasite? No. What happens is this protein has some other function, and the malaria parasite has taken advantage of that. The malaria parasite happens to fit this protein. The HIV, the virus, happens to fit a different protein. So there has been selection for the virus fitting the protein so it can be infectious, and for the malaria parasite fitting this protein so the malaria can be infectious. Now, of course, this is an arms race. There is, in places where there is malaria, there is selection for people who have a variant form of this receptor that does not bind the parasite, and these people are resistant to malaria. And in fact, if you go to parts of the world where people are malaria resistant, there are many variants of this protein that confer resistance. Now, this then is all we want to say today about the red blood cell membrane. Again, this is a specific plasma membrane, but we think other plasma membranes are very similar. They have proteins very similar to spectrin, ankyrin, etc., and they have transmembrane proteins and different ones in different cell types. Now, before I move on to the extracellular matrix, let me ask if there are any questions. Yeah. Yes. Are both of these proteins connected by ankyrin? No. The anion exchanger is connected by ankyrin to the cytoskeleton. You notice in your picture down here, there's a little ball. This is actually protein 4-1. Protein 4-1 actually connects glycophorin to the cytoskeleton. In some pictures, glycophorin is shown unanchored. In some, it's shown anchored to the cytoskeleton. Whether all molecules are anchored, I don't know. So the anchoring protein is often specific to the protein that it anchors, because the anchoring protein has to bind the cytoskeleton, but it also has to stick to or bind the protein that it holds in place. Any more questions? Now, we mentioned earlier the existence of the extracellular matrix, or the proteins on the outside. And I want to talk a little bit about them. There are three classes of protein in the extracellular matrix, and they're diagrammed on 3B, the next to bottom panel. One class of proteins are structural proteins. One is adhesive. And one are so-called proteoglycans, or mucoproteins. So let's start with the structural proteins. These are proteins in the extracellular matrix, which largely provide structural support. And the two major proteins that do that are collagen and elastin. Collagen is probably the most plentiful protein in the human body. Both collagen and elastin are major components of the extracellular matrix in your skin, and they're responsible for the properties of skin. The fact that it's flexible and elastic, especially, is due to elastin. During aging, the collagen gets cross-linked and the elastin gets lost. And that's why the skin of older people is more fragile and thinner and also less elastic. Now, the adhesive proteins hold other things together. And the two most famous ones of those are fibronectin and laminin, as opposed to the lamins that we talked about before. Now, these adhesive proteins are glycoproteins. And collagen is, but elastin isn't. One of the things we want to explain in a minute is the difference between a glycoprotein and a proteoglycan. Both of them are proteins with sugars. But glycoproteins are sort of respectable proteins with a little sugar slapped on. There can be quite a lot of it, but it's not, they're still basically proteins. While this third category is really reversed. It's really a little protein with buckets and buckets of sugar. It's basically sugar. But before we leave the adhesive proteins, what do they do? What do they hold together? If you have fibrous proteins, such as collagen or elastin, in the extracellular matrix, these adhesive proteins can hold them together. These adhesive proteins have many sites which stick to other proteins. But in addition to holding the extracellular matrix together, remember, this is outside a cell, and the cell membrane has transmembrane proteins. So another thing that these adhesive proteins can do is to connect the extracellular matrix to the transmembrane proteins. And remember, many transmembrane proteins are anchored to the cytoskeleton. So this means that the inside of the cell is essentially linked to the outside of the cell, as we mentioned earlier when we said some transmembrane proteins are linkers. Now, I want to look last at the proteoglycans, the third category. These have a core of protein, and then they have very long chains of sugar attached to them. This is quite different than your standard glycoprotein, which has lots of protein, and then it has these short branched chains of sugars. Now, there's a table in the notes that summarizes these differences that you can go back to for reference. So this is a standard glycoprotein. These are both glycoproteins. That is, proteins that are glycosylated or have a little sugar attached to them. But with a proteoglycan, you have a short protein core. But then attached to it are these long linear sugar chains. And these consist usually of two sugars in alternation. So it's A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. And in addition, many of these sugars are modified and have other things stuck to them, such as amino groups. Now, these things are called proteoglycans. But these individual sugar chains also have a name. They're called glycosaminoglycans. And since nobody wants to use a name like that, they're called GAGs for glycosaminoglycans. So they're sugars, A, B, A, B, A, B, where one of them is usually an amino sugar. Now, it turns out you've probably heard of some of these glycosaminoglycans. One of them, and some of them serve a function by themselves as well as being part of a proteoglycan. One of them is heparin, which is used extensively to prevent blood clotting. That's probably not its biological function, but it's used in blood banks to coat the tubing so that it doesn't clot. But the really hot glycosaminoglycan these days is chondroitin sulfate. This is widely taken as a dietary supplement for people with arthritis. They take chondroitin sulfate along with glucosamine. This combination is reputed to help a lot with arthritis. Now, most of you are too young to have arthritis yet, but the bad news is that most of you will probably get it eventually. It is due to problems with the fluid in your joints. The extracellular matrix in your joints gets too dried out or non-slippery, and so you have stiffness of the joints in the hands or the hips or the knees usually. Now, there's a link on the web notes to the latest results of a test of chondroitin sulfate. It's used, chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine are used in addition to the traditional drugs to alleviate pain and increase mobility. And depending on your point of view, the study either showed that the stuff is worthless or it showed that it works. And the reason I said that is that overall, for the whole sample, it had no statistical effect. But for a small subgroup, it did have an effect. And so it's interesting if you look at the various articles that quote this result, some of them say, see, it works, and some of them say, feh, waste of money. So it's not really clear whether this stuff is really helpful, and if so, for whom. For whom? Hopefully by the time you get arthritis, people will have worked this out, and they'll know whether this works, and if it doesn't, they'll come up with something else. But if you want to look at the study yourself, you can. It's linked to the notes. The good thing is that taking this stuff probably has few, if any, side effects, and it's, I think, not that expensive. I haven't tried it yet. My arthritis isn't bothering me. So, okay. Now, there's one more piece of the extracellular matrix we need to mention, and that is called the basal lamina. That perhaps we didn't make it very clear that the extracellular matrix can be liquid or solid. It's often gel-like, primarily because of the proteoglycans, which absorb a lot of water. So a common form of the extracellular matrix is a gel-like substance, though sometimes it can be solid, as in bone, or liquid, as in blood. Now, the basal lamina is a part of the extracellular matrix which is composed primarily of collagen and laminin. And they're formed together into a mat, which forms a solid layer. Sometimes this surrounds cells, but what is even more common is you have a bunch of cells located on top of the basal lamina. So the basal lamina serves both sort of support to hold the cells up, and it also serves to some extent to control what can get to the cells. Now, the basal lamina in older literature is called the basement membrane, and that term is still sometimes used. Now, you can see where the basement part comes from, because it's under a lot of cells and a lot of sheets of cells. And it's a membrane, so-called, because it's a thin layer. But it's not at all like a traditional membrane. It has no lipid. It contains no bilayer. And so people have stopped calling it a membrane and reserved that term for things with bilayers. And instead of calling it that, they call it the basal lamina, just meaning the basal layer. And it's a part of the extracellular material. Now, we keep talking about things being connected, and that's what I want to talk about for next. But are there any questions before I continue? Yes? What is the purpose of the proteoglycans? They actually absorb, they have multiple purposes, but one of them is that they absorb a lot of water, and so they make a gel-like consistency. So we've talked a lot about things being connected, and now I want to look at the specializations of the membrane that allow a connection between one cell and another, and between a cell and the extracellular matrix. And this also is diagrammed on your handout. If you go back to 3B in the middle, second one down, we have the three major kinds of cell-cell connections. Now, these are all called junctions. The one on the left is called a gap junction. The one in the middle is called a tight junction. It's a piece of one. And the thing on the right is called an adhesive junction. And we want to see now how the specialized proteins in the membrane work. Now, we'll start with a gap junction, and it's called that because where these things exist, there's a very small gap between the two cell membranes. So these are the two bilayers of the two adjacent cells. This would be inside one cell. This would be inside the other. And this gap is only a few nanometers. There is a tube-like protein inserted in the membrane of each of these cells. And this protein is called, the structure is called a connexon, and the protein it's made of is called connexin. And this provides a channel that goes from one cell, cytoplasm of one cell, to the cytoplasm of the next. This allows small nutrients, like glucose, to flow from one cell to another. And it also allows ions to move. And that's thought to help with signaling, because if lots of ions come in here and change the electrical properties, they can flow into the next cell and change its electrical properties. So this allows a kind of electrical signaling. Now, how does this setup really look? We drew some cells here that are sort of connected to each other. And I brought some models with me today. Which are of the usual high-tech variety. So these are meant to be cells. So if these cells are connected by gap junctions, what would it look like? The protein, the connexon, the structure of connexin, a connexon actually looks something like this. It has a hole in it, and it's sort of thick. And it's embedded in the membrane. So if it were embedded in this membrane through a hole here, a little bit would stick out on this side, and a little bit would stick in. So if we have two adjacent cells, we could have a connexon embedded in the membrane of this cell and a connexon embedded in the membrane of that cell. And the result is that we have a connection or tube from the inside through the hole in the bagel to the other side. And the only thing wrong with this model is, of course, the scale is way off. The connexons would be little tiny things if this is really the size of the cell. The bagels are too big. And since the bagels stick out, that's why there's a gap here, even though there's a connection or tube between the cells. Now, the second kind of connection is called a tight junction. I'm going to erase this to make it easier. And what we're looking here is at a piece of a tight junction. Tight junctions connect cells so tightly that liquid cannot go between them. And the reason this is important is many cells form layers. So there'd be a whole layer here of these cells. And if this cell forms a layer, if you want to get liquid from this side to that side, if these have tight junctions, the only way to get to the other side is to go through this membrane, through this cell, and out the membrane on the other side. A tight junction prevents the liquid from going in the holes in between. Now, you would think if there was a tight connection, all you would do is sort of glue the two membranes together. But that is not what happens. You connect them at isolated points, but not all along. And in a cell like this, there's often a band of tight junctions here. So there are tight junctions here, 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 same thing here, so that they're connected at this point where the green band is, this one to the next one to the next one, this one to the next one. So what does a tight junction look like? The membrane of the cell forms ridges. So this would be one ridge here. And at this point, there's a protein in this membrane and a protein in the other membrane that are right next to each other, and they are connected. So this forms a link between the two membranes. Now what we're talking about is you have something like this. You have these two. And there are little proteins in here, and there are little proteins in here, and they stick together. But notice the two papers are not completely next to each other. It's only joined along the ridge. So what happens if I were to look at it this way? If I were to look at it that way, here's the surface of the cell. I would see the little bumps from one cell, from the membrane, and the matching cell would have a series of bumps too, and they would bump into each other and connect. And these form ridges, which are irregular. So there is a pattern of bumps on the next cell, which is exactly the same. So this membrane bumps into that membrane only at these points. At this point, the two membranes are not connected. So you have a series of ridges in here. You have a series of ridges and a matching series of ridges here, and they stick out and connect so tightly that liquid cannot go through. Now, before we leave this, what would happen if you did freeze fracture? If you fracture it this way, and it doesn't really matter which membrane it would be, what happens if you break it along that line and I pull off this half? Now, is this the cytoplasm, P half or the E half? This is next to the cytoplasm, so this is the P half. The P face is what I would see if I peeled off all of this stuff and looked at where the pink line is. That would be the P face. Now, if I do that, what about this protein here? This protein is connected to the cytoskeleton. So when I pull off the outer half of the membrane, I will get the protein will go with the P half. So if I look at this half of the membrane, I'll see bumps in it. And if I look at the other half, this part, the E part, I will see holes. Now, last time we talked about a possibility of a freeze fracture that goes this way. And this is the kind of picture we showed you last time, where if you peel away half of this, you notice that what you're looking at here, if we peel all this away, if you take the top off, which surface is this? This is the E. But what about this one down here? This one's a P. So if you crack this diagonally, you would see a patch with holes and a patch with bumps. And that's exactly the picture that's drawn on your handout from last time. Now, tight junctions serve two different functions. One, we've already explained, is a kind of barrier function that prevents things from traveling between the cells. But the other is a different kind of function. I guess you can also think of it as a kind of barrier. That because of the tight junctions here, they're locked in the membrane. Remember, they're attached, the proteins are attached to the cytoskeleton. It means that lipids and proteins that float here cannot float past the tight junctions. And proteins and lipid here cannot float up past the tight junctions. So this divides the cell into two different areas. And you can have one set of proteins and lipids in this area and a different set in the bottom part. Now, what about the final type of junction, or adhesive junction? Here you also have a gap between the cells, but it's larger than in a gap junction. This is 25 to 35 nanometers. This is a big gap junction. Perhaps these should have been called gap junctions, but they're not. So there's a large gap here, and you have a transmembrane protein that sticks out from one cell and a similar one that sticks out from the other, and they lock. And this is what holds the two cells together. Now, this wouldn't work if these proteins weren't anchored. And they are anchored to the cytoskeleton. They are usually attached to a plaque or just the thickening area with containing proteins. And those are then attached to part of the cytoskeleton. However, there are two possibilities here. These fibers here can be either intermediate filaments or they can be microfilaments. That is, they can be made of actin or they can be intermediate filaments. If the fibers are intermediate filaments, the structure is called a desmosome. If they are microfilaments, it's called an adherens junction. Now, there's another difference between these two usually. Usually, a desmosome is a spot or a button. An adherens junction is a belt. And this is most easily diagrammed if we go back to our model cells here. This red band is where the adherens junction or the belt is. That inside the cell, there is a thickening or a plaque, and then protruding out of the cell are these little hook proteins. And then, of course, there are hook proteins from the next cell. So these cells are connected. The part where the red is, there's a whole bunch of hooks. And the part where the red is, there's a whole bunch of hooks. And these two cells are locked at where the red band is. And since this is an adherens junction, the fibers they're attached to inside are microfilaments. And mostly they are thought to go around the cell in a band. So there's a band of microfilaments going all the way around here to which the hooks are attached. So that's an adherens junction. Usually it's a belt. Desmosomes, on the other hand, are spots. So there'd be a little spot here. There'd be a little spot here. On the inside would be the plaque attached to intermediate filaments, and then a hook sticking out. And then on the other cell, at the same spot, you'd have the same similar structure, and the two of them would be linked. Now, this is thought to add enormous rigidity when you have these sheets of cells, because here's a desmosome with its hooks attached to intermediate filaments, which say go like this. And then they go to another desmosome, which links to the next cell, and so on. So you have a series of braces all the way across each direction, formed by these intermediate filaments. So you have these three kinds of structures. And in epithelial cells, which these represent, you actually have all of these different structures. But before we leave this, we want to talk about one other kind of connection. Every connection we've talked about so far is from one cell to the next. It's either a gap junction, a tight junction, or some kind of adhesive junction. But these cells are often attached to the extracellular matrix. In particular, these kinds of cells are often located on top of a basal lamina, and they're hooked to the basal lamina. How do you make a connection not from cell to cell, but from cell to extracellular matrix? It turns out it's just a variation on the adhesive junction. And this is the last thing on 3B. It's on the bottom left. that you have, see, we have a structure here that looks like half an adhesive junction. Except instead of the hook going to a protein from another cell, the hook goes to a protein of the extracellular matrix. Now, in these structures, just as with cell-cell connections, there are two possibilities. These can be intermediate filaments, or these can be microfilaments. Same idea. These can be intermediate filaments or microfilaments. Now, if a cell-cell connection like this is called a desmosome, this thing is called a half-desmosome or a hemidesmosome. It's like a half that's just hooked to the bottom instead of another cell. So that's called a hemidesmosome. If it's hooked to microfilaments, it's called a focal adhesion. And it often lacks the plaque. But it's the same sort of idea that you have filaments inside the cell attached to a transmembrane hook protein, which is attached to the extracellular matrix. So if these cells were sitting on top of a basal lamina, they would have actually hemidesmosomes attached to, which would attach them to the basal lamina. Now, I've been talking about these cells here, and I just want to say a word or two about them, what they represent. And we didn't quite finish it this morning, so we're not going to quite finish it, and you'll need to bring your handout back next time. This kind of cell is an epithelial cell, one of several types, which we'll talk about briefly next time. And these cells generally line surfaces. So they're found in sheets lining things. So, for example, if this is your digestive tract, your gut, it's basically a tube. And there are these cells lining the tube. So if you look now at the other side of your handout on 3A on the top, if you were to cut the tube this way and look from the end, you would see a layer of cells around like this. So if you start with a layer of cells like this, this is what a cross-section of the tube would look like. However, it isn't really like this. It's really ruffled or pushed in. So it looks like the second picture, like this, with a layer of cells. Now, each of these places where it's pushed in is called a villus, or these are villi. But you know that little fleas have littler fleas on them. So the cells themselves have microvilli, or little protrusions. These are the things that are held up by actin microfilaments, as we've discussed before. Now, the net effect of this is to greatly increase the surface of the digestive tract. This way, there's only a relatively low area of surface. But this way, the surface is much, much larger. And people have calculated that the area of your the area of your digestive tract is about the size, the surface area is about the size of a tennis court. So there's a huge area for absorption of stuff from what you eat, one tennis court's worth. Now, if we were to cut a piece here and sort of straighten it out, it would look like this next picture. And what this is meant to be is just a lineup of these kinds of cells. This is the part with the microvilli, and this is the flat part on the bottom. And these kinds of cells have all of the connections which we have talked about. And that's diagrammed in the handout, but we'll bring it back next time and we'll talk briefly about how these cells are connected, and then we're going to discuss how does transport across occur.